Well, you heard the title, friends of the telecast. There's hope. I know of a mother who told her little daughter, everything seems hopeless. Daddy's lost his job. Johnny broke his arm. Grandma has the rheumatism. Mary's got the mumps. Go and say a prayer. So she said a prayer, told God all of the things that had happened, and then she ended it. She said, dear God, please take care of yourself, because if anything happens to you, we're all in the soup. Things really aren't as bad sometimes as they seem. A policeman told me that he went up to a drunk one day who was walking along the curb, and he had one foot up on the curb and the other down in the gutter. He was walking like this. And the cop said, here, you're under arrest, you're drunk. Oh, he says, thank heavens, I thought I was a cripple. Well, the reason we chose this particular title is because the atmosphere of literature, of poetry, of drama, of novels, is so very despairing. We know of many individuals who, from a psychiatric point of view, are what are known as manic depressives. You know, a manic depressive is one whose emotional life is almost like this. In other words, they have their ups and their downs. They're full of enthusiasm, and then in another moment, they're in one of the two or three D's that we have to avoid, the depression and the dumps and the devil. Now, this happens to individuals who are mentally disturbed. I think it happens to civilizations. The 19th century was a civilization of ups. Because in the 19th century, we believed in unlimited progress. We had the brave new world. Everything was getting better and better, thanks to a very necessary evolutionary process. And then, in the 20th century, we got down in the dumps again. Now, why did that happen? Why did we jump from this mountain down to this abyss? Well, I suppose one reason was the rapidity of wars. That made us rather hopeless. Just look at the interval between various wars that we have had. The War of 1870, no, the Napoleonic War, 1850, up to the Franco-Prussian War, 1870, was 55 years. And then from 1870 up to World War I was 43 years. And then from World War I to World War II was 21 years. And along with that, the threat of nuclear destruction. And I suppose that helped put us down into the depths. And how do people meet this despair? That's the question we ought to answer before we show you the way out. Now, I pretty well messed up my blackboard, but oh, the angel this morning, my angel that takes care of the blackboard, You should have seen his hair this morning. It was delightful. I never saw it so beautiful. And I said, well, what are you using? He says, halo. I ought to get a lot of free bottles for that, huh? Now, how do people meet this depression? False ways. Well, one is indifference. That's one of the very common ways that it's met. In other words, they say, well, simply because of the rapidity of wars, and we should just simply shrug our shoulders and say, well, what difference does it make? There's one character in a modern novel was asked, why do you drink? Oh, he said, 24 hours in a day, 23 and a half of those hours. What are they? Hoping, waiting for something? But they're just boring. So I keep on drinking. And then the hours and the minutes and the years pile up. So why not be indifferent about it all? No goals, no purposes, no ideals. This is one way people meet despair. There was a poet in World War I by the name of G. Studdard Kennedy, wrote a poem on indifference, which is a magnificent thing, in which he described Christ coming to Calvary and Christ coming to Birmingham, and how he was treated cruelly at Calvary, and how in Birmingham they paid no attention to him, and he found the crucifixion of Calvary very much more tolerable than the indifference of Birmingham. But this is one attitude. And the other attitude, which is much more common today, is the attitude of revolt. This is the way most people meet despair. They say, life is a snare and a delusion. So they become what? They become placard bearers. They're always marching against something. They don't know what they're marching against, or rather they do know what they're marching against, but they don't know what they're marching for. These modern revolutionists are not like the old style revolutionists, like Lenin, the communist. The communists at least knew why they were revolting. They had a program. If you ask Lenin or anyone who started the communist revolution, they would have explained to you the philosophy of Marx. Modern revolutionists who are in revolt have no program. They can blow up bridges, but they never build any. They're just out for destruction. And this is becoming one of the most common attitudes of our present day in reaction to despair. And of course, they become more despairing of others simply because they do not know where they are going or why they are here. Now, is there another way out? And when I started preparing this telecast, I thought I would do it from a philosophical point of view, but I have given that up, and I am going to touch on it more from the point of view of the drama and the theater. Because the theater is sometimes very much in advance of the thinkers. The dramatists have their fingers on the pulse of contemporary civilization. and they point away. They do not like this indifference. They're getting tired of it. They're even getting tired of the revolters and the placard bearers and the signers. And they're beginning to say that survival is not enough. Now, they have not yet seen the light. But it's interesting that they're getting beyond despair. In one of the very popular plays, there were two characters, both Italians. One had come over from Italy and the other was raised here. And the one who had come over from Italy was violently killed, and the other one said, he never would settle for half. I have. And I've been unhappy. Here was a character, you see, he was looking for commitment. He didn't find it. But he was looking for it. That was hope. But vague, of course. Then there was an Australian dramatist who wrote an odd play called The Summer of the 19th Moon. Summer of the 19th Moon was a story of two sugar cane cutters, Barney and Rue. They lived with two women, unmarried. Sodden with drink. Fed up with sex. Tired of life. Rue said to Olive, he said, we just live in the dust. And that's all there is before us, is dust, dust, dust. So let's get married. Dolly refuses. No, she said, this is despairing of our present condition. There ought to be something else outside of all these dusty roads of ours. She didn't find it. But in any case, the theater was pointing the way beyond revolt and indifference. Then there was another play. It was called Waiting for Godot, G-O-D-O-T. It was written by an Irishman living in France. Who was Godot? It's not a French word. It was generally suggested it was waiting for God. The play was very confusing, dialogue perplexing, monosyllabic, full of all kinds of symbolism. But if anyone took trouble enough to read it over about 20 times, he began to see this dramatist struggling for something beyond revolt. It was the story of two tramps. One who signified the active life and the other the contemplative and mental life. Symbolized them in curious ways. A hat was on too tight and loose boots. They were waiting for Godot. Godot will come along. He will help us. All during the first act, they wait for Godot. Odo does not appear. Finally, there come two tramps, or rather, two characters, one of them named Lucky, and a servant of his. Servant of his, Pozzo, carrying all of his gear and rags and dirt, just a slave. Lo and behold, it turns out that these two represent Godo. Namely, maybe the god we're looking for is not the god that we expected. Maybe he's carrying all of the burdens and anxieties and fears and dreads of the world, like this old Pozzo. It was almost taken out of the 53rd chapter of Isaiah, namely the suffering servant, God who came to this world and took upon himself all of the iniquities and sins and dirts and anxieties and fears of man. That turned out to be Godo. Now this is the way the theater is beginning to grope for something beyond all of this despair. It has not found it yet. One character finally said, well, I think there ought to be some truth beyond all that we've got here, something that would make us shout out, hallelujah, I'm alive. Yes, the dramatists are ahead of the philosophers, and the theologians too, often. So, now, coming to something a little more profound, what is this age like? How should we look at it? Well, there's a description of what happens in the lives of saints that I think we can apply to our times, namely, the dark night of the soul. Saints very often get into one of these troughs, one of these depressions, where they have faith, but they have no sense of faith. They have no feeling whatever of the presence of God, only of his absence. Great Saint Teresa went through that for about 18 years. Now, the law that runs through the spiritual life is that we never come to a higher point in life until we have passed through a lower one. There is a death to something low before there is a birth to something better. Maybe this despair that we find in youth, in the philosophers of the absurd, the novelists of indifference, is this dark night of the soul. There are treasures in darkness. Beyond is the light. Something that happens even in marriage. First the body leads the soul. Then there comes that dark night of marriage where one wonders, well, what's it all about? And then there comes the light and the hope out of it all, namely, the soul begins to lead the body. And there's great happiness. So that our times, I think, are very much like, well, Holy Thursday night in the garden, when the apostles slept out of despair. Something like Easter Sunday afternoon when the disciples were walking on the way to Emmaus. And the blessed Lord, unknown to them, joined them on the way, and he said to them, why are you so sad? Why sad? Why downcast? And they said, didn't you hear what happened? That we who thought he was the Savior of Israel dead. And yet in a few hours, there he was. And that's the moment we are now. There's hope. And to bring it to something more personal, there was an Archbishop of Paris who gave a very famous sermon at Notre Dame Cathedral. In the course of the sermon, he told of a priest who was hearing confessions. And in his confessional, he could hear three boys outside. They were revolters. They were saying, God is dead. This is a sepulchre, a tomb. Then they decided, let's see if we can make fun in some way of what is in here. And they hit upon the idea of one of them going in and making a confession, just for the joke of it. So they agreed, anybody that would be brave enough to go in and make a confession, we will give to him 5 francs. So one boy said, all right, I'll go in. So when he went in, made his confession, the priest, pretending he didn't know anything about the conversation, and accepting the confession as if it were genuine, gave him as a penance. He said, go up to the communion rail. Kneel down at the communion rail and say, God's dead. And I wouldn't want you to help me even though I needed you. So I'll go to hell. So the boy came out, said to the others, all right, give me the 5 francs. And they said, oh no, you must have gotten a penance. Go and say your penance. So he went up to the communion rail and he started. He got out the words, God is dead, and then he choked. And he couldn't finish the words, and he began to cry. And the Archbishop, continuing his sermon, said to his congregation, I am that boy. And that is the way I think the world is today. Like a brave little boy, just half brave. And yet on the way to light. For there's hope beyond in the resurrection. We can bear anything in this world, any kind of a how. So long as we know the why. And the why was given on the way to Emmaus. There's hope. I'll be back. In the meantime, bye now, and God love you.